And a very good morning out there, everybody. This is Dr. Andrew Dyer, your host for today. And it's good to be back live in studio today as we prepare for a little rainy Saturday coming up. But today our topic is entitled Vitamins and Clinical Nutrition, Where the Evidence Really Matters. I am a doctor of chiropractic. I'm also board certified in clinical nutrition. The only board certified clinical nutritionist currently taking and seeing patients at Take Two Healthcare. And we're located in Centerville on State Route 48 in between Whip and Ron Roads. If you want to get a hold of us on the phone, it's 937-433-3241 at the office. If you want to get a hold of us here today live in studio, the number to call is 937-957-1290. But we're going to dive right in. I want to welcome you to the show. Today we're talking about a subject that sits right at the intersection of nutrition, medicine, and public health, and that is vitamins and disease. Now, vitamins are often marketed like they are a universal solution. You get the latest and greatest, hottest product that's been advertised all over social media, and it's going to automatically give you more energy, stronger immunity, better brain function, healthier aging, fewer chronic diseases. But we know that's not always possible. We know it's rarely possible. And in clinical nutrition, the real question is much more precise. It isn't, are vitamins good? The real question is, in which diseases, in which patients, at which dose, and with what evidence? That distinction really matters. Because when vitamins are used appropriately and well, they can be absolutely transformative. In the right setting, they can prevent birth defects, reverse deficiency syndromes, and slow progression of specific disease states, along with correcting clinically meaningful pathology. But when they're used indiscriminately, they can be sometimes a waste of money, because not everything being marketed to you on social media or on the billboards driving along the highway is necessarily what your body needs right now. And how would you even know what dosage to begin with? They can create false hope, they can delay diagnosis, and sometimes even cause harm. Now, those situations are rare, but it can happen. Too much of a good thing may be too much. So in this episode, what I really want to do is something practical. We're going to focus on five evidence-based clinical scenarios where vitamins have real relevance. Now, some of these conditions you likely have heard of before. Some of them you may not have. And for the average listener, maybe this condition doesn't affect you, but you may see it in somebody you're talking to at church or in your neighborhood, your neighbor, a loved one. You may be able to identify some of these things just with your knowledge you're going to gain today. So thiamine is vitamin B1, and that's a common deficiency in a condition called Wernicke's encephalopathy. That's our first topic of the day. Then we're going to talk about folic acid and neural tube development, the aid in how folic acid is used for proper neural tube development, or defect prevention is another way of saying it. We'll talk about B12 and the deficiencies there related to anemias and neurologic disorders. And then specific vitamin compilations and collections to address eye-related disorders. So more specifically, age-related MACD. Age-related macular degeneration is the fourth topic of the day. And then the fifth and final one, no good discussion of vitamin therapy would be complete if we didn't put vitamin D in the mix. But today, on a really specific topic, bone diseases, especially deficiency-related osteomalacias, things that we don't commonly see abound in our current society because of risk prevention strategies, but they are worldwide problems. And if they're identified quickly, they can be corrected. But if it's too late, then the skeleton is already doing its thing and not developing the bones in a proper way. Along the way, we'll keep returning to one core principle, and that is vitamins work best in the clinical setting when they are targeted to a defined biological problem, not when they're treated like a magic cure-all for everything. So let's start with one of these very, very clear examples. And important to note, as we talk about this B1 deficiency found in Wernicke's encephalopathy, it's a medical emergency hiding in plain sight. It also could cause confusion yes, in that patient, but it could cause the practitioner or clinician to be a little confused and be thinking, oh, this is another type of neurological disorder, maybe an Alzheimer's or a dementia state, because some of the symptoms overlap. If you want that example, here it is. Thiamine deficiency, or B1, is essential for carbohydrate metabolism. So when we eat things that have sugar in them, if we don't have enough B1 in our system, we can't efficiently break those things down. And they help with neuronal energy production. So actually allowing the nerves, which, where's the biggest collection of those? In the brain, to produce energy and to work properly. So when thiamine is severely depleted, we have these high energy tissues, especially in the brain, that start to show signs of failure. Many clinicians learn this classic triad for Wernicke's, which is confusion, eye movement abnormalities, and gait ataxia. Meaning, if you're watching somebody walk, there should be a smooth flow of right foot, left arm, left foot, right arm, how we watch track athletes warm up before they jump over hurdles. That kind of movement is smooth and controlled by proper brain function. But if it's not working properly, it could be a sign of vitamin B1 deficiency. And that is, folks, a medical emergency. Now, have I ever seen this condition walk into our practice? No, absolutely not. But do I know the signs and do I know where to send the patient? Absolutely so. Now, at the onset of identifying this condition, because it's so time sensitive, and if these neurologic systems don't get the support they need early and often, this condition can advance into a more significant form of the syndrome, and it's two named doctors together. It's Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome at that point. The name is irrelevant really in today's discussion, but identifying it quickly and properly with the right amount of testing, the right kind of testing, and then getting the patient into treatment quickly could save someone's life. So the same review that notes that this type of encephalopathy often develops after just 4 to 6 weeks of the deficiency of this vitamin. Well, good news. If you have a healthy liver and you're actually taking in a diet broad enough to contain some B1, not just some, you need about 100 milligrams a day to actually correct this condition. You need about 50 milligrams a day for storage in the liver. The liver can store a 1 month supply of B vitamins within it, provided we're not washing it all out with too many alcoholic beverages. This condition is commonly found in patients that abuse or use too much alcohol. So there's ways to treat. There's need to be treated quickly in this condition because it can prevent the progression of a more serious problem from developing. So that's an important one. Need to know it, need to identify it. And if you've seen somebody in your inner circle that has some of these problems and they've been given a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or dementia, maybe they need to get their vitamin B1 levels checked in their blood. And if that's the case and they've been dealing with this for a long time, they need treatment like yesterday. Now, topic two for the day, we've got five of them. Topic two is folic acid and neural tube defects. Now, almost everybody that understands some of the basics around human nutrition understands that if we're given enough folic acid, now this is for female patients in this particular case, because they're growing this new baby inside of their bodies. And if they have enough folic acid, that is going to help prevent neural tube defects. Well, here's a common example of neural tube defects: spina bifida. Spina bifida and some other ancillary related neural tube defects can be prevented if folic acid is utilized, but we cannot wait until after we've identified a pregnancy to get this started, because at that point it's already too late. Why? Because neural tube begins to develop within the first few weeks of pregnancy. Often before this young lady even knows, or any lady, doesn't have to be a young lady, but any time before this female patient even identifies as being pregnant. So we have to, the recommendation is that any lady in the right age category to develop a pregnancy should be taking folic acid as a preventative measure for neural tube defects in case they become pregnant. That's exactly what the studies show. In a 1991 MRC vitamin study, there was a randomized double-blind prevention trial in women at high risk because of previously affected pregnancies. There was a 72% protective effect for folic acid supplementation on recurrent neural tube defects. So 72 upwards of that percent of the time, these issues could be prevented with putting one particular nutrient into the body, but it has to be timed appropriately and has to be started even prior to pregnancy to really do the job. That's absolutely extraordinary information. In medicine, we often deal with modest effects, marginal gains, and conflicting meta-analyses in the studies, but folic acid in this context is very different. This is a nutrient intervention with major public health significance, solid biologic plausibility, and strong trial support. CDC also notes a special case for someone with a previous pregnancy affected by a neural tube defect. The recommendation on dosage may be upwards of 4,000 micrograms per day, starting a month before becoming pregnant again and continuing further for the first 3 months of pregnancy or entirely through that first trimester. Now, when the public hears folate, they often assume that eating leafy greens occasionally will be enough. And while food folate truly matters, the CDC specifically emphasizes folic acid, the supplemental, and yes, a fortified form is found often in our foods, but supplementally we can give a really more appropriate form of this nutrient because that's the form shown to prevent neural tube defects. So there's a variety of uses out there for folic acid. It is often, and in our case, in our clinic, packaged together with vitamin B12, which we'll talk about on the other side of the break. But B12 and folic acid are often given together because they have what's called a synergistic effect, meaning if we give the right amount of B9 and balance it with some B12, both will get absorbed more appropriately. So that's a key piece. And if you have a knowledgeable clinical nutritionist working alongside you, they'll know that and they'll give you the right form and they'll test you before and after and maybe prevent some really big problems for your future offspring. That would be significant. And it's a huge public health concern and something that needs to be addressed. We're going to stop right there. We're going to come back on the other side and talk about B12. And we'll do that after this first break. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning on Take Two Healthcare, your guide for better living on WHIO. And we are back. Thank you very much. We're going to take a short break from our topic and share with you a case study that came across my desk this week again. It is an update to a case that I had been working on and posting, but it was about heart. It was about heart health and using our advanced coronary panel of blood assessment. It's not our panel, but it's a panel we order often on patients that helps us to identify where the issues might be hiding from a heart and circulatory standpoint. So from an arterial blockage standpoint, the term is atherosclerosis. So that's when the arteries over time get harder, they become more filled with plaque, and there are clinical nutrition remedies to reverse that condition. And I have a great case here where when we tested this particular patient in the year 2023, her ADMA was high at 110. Now, she's in her early 70s, tested right at the end of the year in 2023. And we know that the condition of atherosclerosis develops over time. So it's over many decades that things are turning the corner that way. And so if we start utilizing treatment modalities, whether that's the inclusion of ubiquinol, fish oil, vitamin E, resveratrol, we have many options. And then we monitor the change over time, we expect to see those numbers improve. And in this case, that's exactly what happened. So 110 on her lab value was 10 points higher than it should have been based on the clinical range. When we came back and tested it again at the very end of the year 2024, so 1 year later, we dropped that number down from 110 to 85, which put it right back in the healthy range for her. So even though that condition over a multitude of years was developing, we were able to get documented reversal on that within 1 year's time, utilizing nothing but vitamin and mineral support. There was no, she takes no medications at all She reacts very significantly to any of the meds she even has to consider taking for things like dental procedures and other issues that she deals with. But that is why she's always focused on how can she maintain her health without having to rely on drug therapy. And in this case, that's exactly what we saw. Now, another quick study from this week, I had a patient reach out to me on our interoffice messaging system, and she said, well, my medical doctor tested me and my B12 levels in the serum are very high, and she said that's a problem and I need to stop right away. And I wrote her back quickly and I said, well, B12 is really not an issue of getting too high in the blood because it's a water-soluble nutrient. So any extra that the body has available, it will be quickly excreted through the urine. But in her case, because of previous GI surgeries, she's had bariatric surgery for weight loss and metabolic management. And as a result of that, some of her B vitamin absorption capabilities are a little off. Now, in the context of which B vitamins can get too high and cause a problem, B6 is the nutrient where if we give a higher dose than the body needs, it can create the exact problem that we're trying to impact with it. And that is sometimes known as neuropathy. Now, I'm going to switch over to B12 now, but B6 is the one that if we give too much, it can be problematic. So on B12, if we don't have enough, we can certainly develop anemia, the condition I just mentioned, neuropathy, and even nutrition neurology connection here, where if deficiency of B12 is found, it can produce what's called megaloblastic anemia. The condition there is found with fatigue, pallor, glossitis. So the tongue actually becomes swollen and inflamed, and even other neuropsychiatric symptoms. So B12 deficiency can be a big, big problem. Now, B12 excess really isn't usually an issue, but of course what we did was we throttled down on her dosage. She's due for her annual testing here in the next couple months, so we'll get a better and closer look at it. But those people that are commonly found with B12 deficiency are those that have had gastric surgeries, have maybe an inflammatory bowel disease, something like celiac, ulcerative colitis. There are others, Crohn's, and even metformin use for longer than 4 months. That medication is known to leach B12 from the system. Proton pump inhibitors, which are commonly used to protect people that have GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disorder. And if they've been on it more than 12 months, it becomes a more common issue of B12 deficiency. Vegans or strict vegetarians can also suffer from this because their diet is lacking in that particular category. I've treated many vegans and vegetarians over the years. Some of them really do need to do a better job with B12, but it is possible to keep your B12 levels up without ever eating organ meats. It is possible. And then adults over 75, because changes occur in the gut as we're aging with the output of acids to help break down foods. And with those changes, B12 gets lost in the shuffle. The other key component there, and we got to take a break. The other key component is if we don't have good normal flora balance in our gut, we can't maximize our own B12 production. So we're going to take a break. I'm just getting fired up. We got two more topics to cover out of our five. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer on AM 1290 and News 95.7 WHIO. And we are back. Thank you, Chris. Dr. Andrew Dyer here with you live on Take Two Healthcare, your guide to better living. Had a caller over the break. She didn't want to come on air, and that's okay. We can take care of this just the way we're going to. She had a question about a diagnosis she was given called Terry's nails. Just like the name Terry, T-E-R-R-Y, apostrophe S. And in this particular condition, the fingernails appear white, or they have what they call in clinical medicine a ground glass opacity. So they don't look normal. They don't look like they have that nice pink color underneath. There may even be a brownish colored band at the tip of the nail. And this is commonly found in several other clinical conditions. It can be from an overgrowth of connective tissue, and that connective tissue is kind of displacing the blood vessels under the nail bed. So the nails are not getting perfused with new blood as a result of this overgrowth of connective tissue, but it commonly occurs in several significant health conditions. Those include liver disease. So liver failure, cirrhosis, viral hepatitis, those are examples of liver disease. Heart conditions like congestive heart failure. That's where I've seen it in patients, is those that have congestive heart failure. They're typically not getting good blood flow all the way to the tips of their digits. Now, this can affect the fingernails primarily, but it can also affect the toenails. Kidney issues like chronic kidney disease or failure. Endocrine problems like type 2 diabetes, even hyperthyroidism. And then other kind of down the road conditions, malnutrition, even HIV, which is obviously a very significant immune diagnosis, and then certain skin or inflammatory conditions. Now, the caller wanted to know what to do for this. Well, that answer is not as simple as, okay, take this amount of this vitamin, this amount of this herb or nutrient. It's not like that. It's, we got to get you tested, or somebody who knows what they're doing needs to get you tested to figure out where the health problems are. And then start working on those. So really, this is a sign that your body's giving you that something's not working appropriately. And we'd be happy to help you with that, to help you get tested properly. You can give our office a call Monday morning, and our lovely staff will help you get scheduled. But that condition is really more of a body sending you a wake-up call or a signal to say, something's out of balance here, and we need to figure out what it is so we can treat that appropriately. And the fingernails can and will change if the body's given the right supportive nutrients, but it will be at least a 1 year long process to grow out a new nail from bottom to top. Now, this is not a nail bed issue or injury. It's just, that's the little window inside the body. And I do look at fingernail color on a lot of the patients that I see, especially if their symptoms are aligned with some of these problems. Then we assess that and we look at it. It's a very subjective look, but it helps me figure out which test to order appropriately for them, and then helps allow for the right treatment plan to be put in place. Just diving back in quickly to finish our B12 topic, as far as dosage goes, and really the key piece here is American Family Physician Review states that high dose oral vitamin B12, meaning taken through the mouth, we typically give it in a sublingual form that goes under the tongue, 1 to 2 milligrams daily, which on the back of the bottle, it will say 1,000 micrograms per tab. And we can sometimes give 2 to 4 of those, depending upon how the blood levels look for each patient, is as effective as intramuscular injection for correcting anemia and neurological symptoms. Many, many patients have been kind of lulled into the false sense of security that getting a B12 intramuscular injection is a better way to go. I liken it to this. Say you're washing up your knives and silverware in the kitchen sink, and you leave this sponge down at the bottom, and that sink is just trickling out a little bit of water. It takes much longer for that sponge to become fully saturated with water if a slow trickle is being given, right? Versus you turn that faucet on full blast like a fire hose, that sponge gets saturated very quickly, and then whatever doesn't get caught up in the sponge runs down the drain. That's my comparison analogy for a B12 intramuscular injection, which I have never, ever taken in my life, but I use a sublingual form of B12 nearly every day because my blood work says that would help me, and it does help me. So keep that in mind, that just because some of the area stores and clinics are offering an intramuscular form of this nutrient, it may not be what your body actually needs. Second to last, ARIDS2. ARIDS2 is a common eye nutrient given for age-related MACD. I don't love this particular nutrient because I don't think it's formulated correctly. Now, I'm not here to say, oh, this product is no good at all. It is quite good. It has a lot of the right things in it. I just think it lacks on a couple of key elements, because the dosage size is vitamin C at 500 milligrams. Yes, I understand that's the recommended daily allowance level, but if you've got a significant eye problem, wouldn't you want to actually correct that rather than just giving a welfare level to the body? That's not appropriate in every clinical sense. Vitamin E, now they get this one close, 400 IUs, doesn't tell me which form they're using, and that is key. If it's a synthetic version of vitamin E, that's a problem. Body's not going to absorb it very well, and we're probably going to need 800 IUs, if not more, only if the patient's not on a blood-thinning medication. See, all these things have to be taken into consideration or taken into account when we're walking through the health food store or the pharmacy and just grabbing a load of vitamins saying, well, these are going to help me fix my eyes. Yeah, but did you talk to somebody that really knows what you might need to steer clear of? Now, they give 2 milligrams of copper, 10 milligrams of lutein, and 2 milligrams of zeaxanthin in there. Copper, lutein, zeaxanthin, excellent for eye health. But what if the patient has Wilson's disease? Wilson's disease is copper accumulation in the blood. Actually tested a patient for this yesterday. Didn't test him yesterday. We got the results back on him yesterday. Copper levels in the blood were low, and the backup supply for copper called ceruloplasmin was also low. He doesn't have Wilson's disease. Therefore, he can take copper if needed. I didn't put him on any, but we will get him some trace amounts within our vital trace minerals and our multiple vitamin. But he doesn't need additional copper in this form. He's not dealing with this eye problem. He's dealing with some changes in cognitive health. Now, copper is an important nutrient when we're talking about zinc, because copper and zinc are a little bit similar to calcium and magnesium in that they need each other to be absorbed appropriately and properly. Now, the dosages don't necessarily match. So zinc, we can give 40, 50, 60 milligrams per day if needed. Copper only needs to be around 10 or less to keep the balance. But we look at these levels on every patient we test. Within their hair test, the output of copper and zinc really help us figure out what might be left behind in the body. And then if needed, we can order blood levels of copper and zinc. Because without doing that, we really don't know what the body has or is missing. Now, the AREDS2 formula makes it quick and convenient in that it's in 2 capsules a day. But we could give a similar supportive nutrient option to our patients with about 3 different nutrients instead of 2 if we wanted to bump up the dosages a little higher. And typically, if you're faced with, I will go blind within the next couple of years, or I could take 3 to 4 vitamins each morning, I think most people are going to opt for the 3 to 4 vitamins so they can keep their sight. I mean, that's just me, but that's what I would think. And that's what I've seen patients do over the years. And so it's not that every single patient with this diagnosis needs this exact same formula, but it's a good starting point. It's well-researched. They have made some changes to the formula over the years, but there's really good benefits when we're giving the right supportive vitamins for eye health that really can help people maintain that function going forward. Think of if you were faced with losing your sight or just voluntarily taking vitamins at breakfast and dinner each day. I think the decision's pretty easy. Now, I told you we were going to talk about vitamin D. I love talking about vitamin D. Usually I do it in a sense of cancer protection or heart disease or other big prominent conditions. Today's focus is on bone health. There's a lot written lately and a lot seen in the literature here recently about even injectable meds that are used and given every 6 months to help stop some of that bone deterioration. Well, I was talking about this with my wife last night, and I said, even one of the young soccer players for England, he tripped over a billboard on the side of the stadium and broke his wrist. And the reason we talked about that last night is this is, in theory, one of the most fit professional athletes on the planet. He's played in 4 World Cup games in the last few weeks, around 90 minutes each game, and now he's got a broken wrist and probably can't play this evening. But the doctors, when you meet with them about your DEXA scan results, they give you this number that determines fracture risk. And then they really kind of pile on by saying, well, anything you do from here on out, if you slip, fall, trip getting out of your car, fall down the stairs, slip coming out of the shower or bath, you could be at risk for fracture. Well, okay, yes. But essentially, aren't we all at risk for fracture? If I fell coming out of my shower, I'm probably going to be okay, but I might have to go get an x-ray to make sure. And a DEXA scan looks at prominent areas of the body where we know there's going to be strong bones and maybe potentially some weaker bones. And it usually looks at the head of the femur, so the top part of the hip. It looks at that femoral neck right underneath it where a common fracture risk is considered. And then it typically also looks at the lumbar spine. The problem with the way that that is done to a degree is when you image the lumbar spine with a DEXA scan, those dual absorption x-rays have to penetrate all the tissue from the side of your body to your spine and then out the other side. And for some people, depending upon their size, there's an awful lot of tissue in the way. The vertebral bodies are only a couple inches wide, but if your waist and trunk is 44 inches in diameter, you got to get through about 20 inches before you even get to the spine. So that makes the assessment a little bit difficult. That's why they do many of the other areas. But there's a common way to handle that, which is lab tests to coordinate vitamin D status. And then not just stopping there, but also looking at two other cofactors to help the body absorb vitamin D. No, it's not K2. It's calcium and magnesium. K2 is one of the rare exceptions. I had a patient ask me this yesterday. He said, what's with all the D3 and K2 combined? What's cut to the chase here for me? What do I need to know? I said, well, you need to know that vitamin K does help absorb D3, but it is one of the rare exceptions that if our diet is vast in the green leafy vegetable intake on a consistent basis, we can accumulate enough K2 in our system so where we don't need to supplement with it. Now, I don't say that often about many of the other nutrients because it's not possible in most of the other cases. For example, vitamin C, if we want to give 3,000 milligrams and we count on the average orange, which has 50 milligrams in it, that's an awful lot of oranges to get to that dosage per day. It'd be pretty impossible to keep your sugars stable eating that many oranges every day. So vitamin K2, while it certainly is a cofactor for D3, they're both fat-soluble nutrients, so we would never, ever recommend a patient go on K2 or D3 for that matter without knowing what their blood levels are. And actually, the blood or serum test for K is vitamin K1 in the serum, but the solution or treatment form is actually giving the vitamin K2 form, or menaquinone, it's also known as. And it's a pretty small dose, 100 to 180 micrograms, so mcgs, not milligrams, but micrograms of K2, if needed. But again, without testing, we wouldn't know. So the today's discussion of D3 is really the unquestioned biologic role in calcium absorption and bone mineralization. Now, we know there's more to it than just vitamin D intake, but it's essential for bone health. The deficiencies should be recognized and treated. We need to give the right form of calcium. That brings me to another point. I know we've got a break coming up, but calcium MCHC. If you're taking calcium carbonate or any other form of calcium, you're not getting the most bang for your buck. You're putting potentially your kidneys at a small risk if you're not combating that with good water intake and good magnesium intake. But MCHC is the correct form of calcium to utilize if you want to make the bones stronger. That was a study done at University of Maryland probably 30, 40 years ago. Professor Robert Shangraw came up with this study format where he looked at all the available calcium supplement forms and food forms and boiled down all the best results. And the one that ranked at the top was calcium MCHC. It is the only calcium we have in our clinic available for patients. Because why not? Why not? And I'm purposely not giving you the dosage that you need, because if I don't test you, I don't know the dosage you need. Now, some of the studies talk about in postmenopausal women giving a load of up to 2,100 milligrams per day. I can tell you we never use that much and we get great results. We use about 1,000, maybe a little less, depending upon need. And I know we're going to take a break. We are going to do that right now. We'll come back. We'll wrap things up. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer on AM 1290 and News 95.7 WHIO. And we are back, just closing things out here. If that music doesn't get you fired up, then nothing will. The big picture here, when vitamins really help disease. So what do these five examples tell us? They tell us that vitamins are the most powerful in medicine when at least one of these following things is true. First, there's got to be a clear deficiency syndrome. Example, that thiamine deficiency we talked about early on, Wernicke's encephalopathy, or B12 deficiency contributing to anemia and neuropathy. Second, there's a highly defined risk preventative window, like folic acid prior to conception and during early pregnancy to help reverse those neural tube defects like spina bifida. Third, there's a specific disease stage with trial-tested benefit, like in the example of the eyes, in that intermediate age-related macular degeneration, or vitamin D in selected bone health contexts. And maybe the deeper lesson is this. Clinical nutrition is not about treating vitamins like magical substances. It's about understanding the biology, the risk, the timing, and the evidence. A vitamin can be life-saving in one setting and even unhelpful in another. A supplement can be evidence-based for one disease stage and pointless for others. A nutrient deficiency can mimic neurologic disease, psychiatric, or even hematologic disease. And sometimes the best nutrition intervention is not, quote-unquote, eat healthier, but rather to recognize the exact nutrient-linked pathology right in front of you. That is the maturity of clinical nutrition. Not hype, not fear, not supplement absolutism, just careful matching of nutrient therapy to human disease. So hopefully you enjoyed today's episode and you got a little something out of it. We talked about five specific tenets where clinical nutrition approaches could be life-saving. We also talked about Terry's nails. If you look down at your nail beds today and you see all white, that's a clinical indicator that you should get a blood test done. And you need a blood test that covers a variety of spaces and places in the body, and not limited to just liver, kidneys, thyroid, but even looking at immune system, heart. And yes, there are great blood markers for heart, C-reactive protein, BNP for congestive heart failure. There are many. And we utilize them on a regular basis in our office. So if you haven't had a blood test in a while, and when I say a while, if you haven't been blood tested within a year and you're having some significant issues creeping up on you, there's no time to waste. Give us a call. We can certainly help out. I had a great Cairo case this week, too. A young golfer came in. He's 38 years old. Couldn't swing his club on Wednesday morning. I adjusted him one time in the office after examination. I saw him again Friday morning. He said, "How'd you do?" He said, "Well, I played 41 holes yesterday." I said, "Wow, that was amazing." He got better after one treatment. Now, again, that doesn't happen to everybody, but young, healthy, athletic people certainly do get better faster. If you don't fit that box, that doesn't mean you can't get better. Just means it usually takes a little bit longer. So thank you for listening today. Try to stay safe inside if we're going to get some storms this afternoon, but we'll be back again next Saturday. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer for Take Two Healthcare, your guide to better living on WHIO.